Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
My rule of thumb is basically, if you have less than $5,000 of credit card debt, add an extra $50 every month to the minimum monthly payment. However you have, like whatever you have to do to get that money. Hop on TaskRabbit and see what service of yours, like you could teach snowboarding lessons, something that would be fun and that you could get an extra $50 a month to add. If you have between $5,000 and $10,000 of credit card debt, add an extra $50 to your minimum monthly payment. And if you have, over $10,000, add an extra $150. And, if you do that, you will, and you have a typical mid-teens interest rate on your credit card debt, you will compress the number of years it takes to pay off that debt dramatically. Using that formula, you can, depending on the interest rate, you can get all that debt paid off in 3 to 5 years.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact? You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips. Manisha, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Trini, thank you so much for having me here today.
Yeah, it is my pleasure to have you here. So I actually was introduced to you by way of your publicist who told me a little bit about the work that you've done. And it was particularly around a subject that I think is of interest to a lot of people, myself included, and that is the idea of money. But before we get into all of that, I want to start by asking you, what is one of the most important things that you've learned from one or both of your parents that have influenced and shaped who you've become and what you've ended up doing with your life?
Oh, gracious. Just one, right? I have a toss up between two, but I'll only tell you the story about one because the other one relates to money, so we can get to that. But the first lesson that my parents taught me, my dad taught me early on about the power of compounding. My mom taught me that money gives women voices and choices. And early on, they both taught me how to live within my means and emphasize that so strongly with their own behaviors. But we'll come back to that. Other lesson that they gave me that I think is really, really shaped my life is this notion that with that money, that I would do all of those things that they taught me how to do, and that I have a choice and I could choose things or experiences. And as I look back on my life, most likely there will be some things that will be profoundly meaningful to me, maybe a home in a certain place. But most likely the things I will remember most are experiences. And I have to tell you, I had a near-death experience. It was 2013. I had gone to Laos and I was bit by an infected mosquito, and I came down with dengue fever. And the incubation period is such that I must have gotten bit on my last day there. I was in the jungles and I was really careful to have the DEET on everywhere. And the last day I was in the Capitol and I was wearing a tank top and I applied stuff in the morning, but I didn't reapply because I thought, yes, I made it through the whole trip with no mosquito bites. And I got back to the U.S. and I was in Houston, Texas, giving a speech. It was about noon and I started to feel worse and worse. And I lived in Santa Fe, New Mexico at that time. And you fly from Houston into Albuquerque and then drive an hour from Albuquerque to Santa Fe. And I have literally no recollection of getting myself back home to Santa Fe. But I arrived with over 103 degree fever. I ended up in the emergency room and it was just like a series of a comedy of errors because Santa Fe, New Mexico is a very small town and no one had even stopped to consider that I had dengue. And anyways, long story short, I had a series of complications that almost resulted as in organ failure and death. And so I thought I was going to die and they thought I was going to die and my family thought I was going to die and everyone flew in. And I can remember one point where I was just shaking so much. I was like a cartoon character. My teeth were rattling. And I thought, oh my God, this is it. This is how it's going to end. And it's funny, what ran through my mind was my family, my friends, and a couple of places that I had been, in the thought that, well, at least I had lived life. I've seen things. So it turns out my parents' advice was true, and I'm going to keep seeking experiences.
Wow. So being confronted with your own mortality, I wonder how it changed the way you lived your life after the experience.
Oh, gracious. Well, I divorced my husband. I changed jobs. I moved to a new state without knowing anyone. It gives you this sense of, holy crap. I'm 48 now. So, you know, I was in my early 40s when that happened. The sense of, wow, like it could happen at any time. If something's not working, like, you need to change it now. And so I made some really drastic changes in my personal life. And then, unfortunately, I went back to all my old bad habits, the biggest of which is workaholism, which crowds out the ability to have experiences. And so I guess what I want to say is, it was this wonderful wake-up call, but human nature is so hard to fight against. And so, you know, on one hand, I feel like I took some dramatic actions that I wouldn't have taken. On the other hand, I feel like the tsunami of your habits are frequently pushing back against you. And I quickly fell back into those habits, and but that awareness is with me. So I think it's like something that you can't unforget. Mm-hmm. So that's the impact, I would say.
Wow. You're of Indian descent, right?
Yes. My dad is Indian and my mom's American.
Okay. Oh, wow. Okay. So that raises a whole bunch of other questions that I didn't even know I wanted to ask. So I guess the thing that I wonder, right, as a woman in your 40s who has, you know, been somewhat indoctrinated into Indian culture, you know, who gets divorced, I wonder, you know, how you wrestle with that in your own life. Because, you know, I think somebody had asked me once on a podcast, what do you like most about being a man? And I remember my answer was, from a cultural perspective, I said, you know what, if I had the choice between being my age and a single guy in India, and my age and a single woman in Indian, I would choose single guy every time, because I think that Indian women deal with such a level of pressure that is such a double standard. And I wonder, as somebody who's been through this experience, what your view is on that.
Oh my gosh. Could say so much about that. So I met my ex-husband when I was in my early 30s. He was 20 years older than me. And at that point in time, I literally felt like I was a blight on my family's reputation and standing, because I was so old and still single. And all my cousins were married. They'd all had kids, and I'm the old maid. And I felt like milk past my sell-by date. And I could tell when we would go back to India, even my aunties thought the same thing. Like, you know, there were no more casual introductions. They'd like given up on me. And I just remember when my ex-husband and I got together, I was, when we got married, I was 33 and 34. And the joy from the Indian side of my family was, it was palpable. And I felt like I had solved this huge weight on everybody's shoulders. And they were just, everyone was so happy that I was getting married. In retrospect, my ex-husband is an amazing person, and we now have a very cordial relationship, but it never even occurred to anyone, like, is this the right person? What are you, you know, they were just so, I could have married a wall and they would have been thrilled. And when I got divorced because my Princess Diana has this favorite, this classic line when she was interviewing with Martin Bashir in her scandalous tell-all interview, the first time a royal had sat down with the media. And she said, there were three of us in this marriage, so it was a bit crowded. And that's what had happened to me. And when I divorced my husband, nobody could understand. Like, they literally thought I had gone off my rocker. And I didn't want to tell them why, because I felt like that would bring even more shame to my family. Like, I would rather them think I was absolutely nuts than think that I had not been a good enough wife and therefore my husband had gone elsewhere. And it was just this, and yet at the same time, I felt that by getting divorced, and I was the first of, you know, the extended of my generation to do so, that I brought such shame on my family. And mind you, I grew up in the U.S. I did my undergrad at Wellesley. I went to Harvard Business School. Like, you know, like, I have a very Western side, but oh my gosh, it was like so deep in my DNA.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So you mentioned that your parents taught you about experiences to live within your means. And, you know, it's funny because I feel like, at least from my experience as an Indian kid, you get raised with one sort of very dominant narrative, and that is that money is scarce, to the point where even when, you know, Indian people are well off, I see things that just shock me, like, you know, driving across town to save a couple of bucks on, you know, filling up a gas tank.
You're describing my dad.
Well, I kind of was shocked. You know, I remember, you know, my dad would go out of his way to go to Costco to get gas. And I'm like, wait a minute. I'm like, you drive a really nice car, like a $70,000 Mercedes. I'm like, why the hell does $2 make a difference? And so, you know, I mean, I get that, you know, living within your means makes sense. And it's funny because I think that this is one of those things where my sister, I think, had a very different relationship with money growing up because of the fact that she saw my parents more well off than they were when I was. And I've struggled with it throughout my adult life. And sometimes I think it's because of that, that I've had a tendency to, you know, live, you know, above my means at times, find myself in situations. So last year I made almost no money, and the year before I made plenty. And I found myself in a situation where I had to live off my credit cards. And it was kind of fitting that I was talking to you today because my dad and I were just talking about an issue I was having with one of my cards. And so I wonder, one, you know, why you think it is that, one, this conversation about financial literacy doesn't start happening at an early age, and where do these sort of inaccurate ideas that lead to situations like mine come from? Like, how does that happen?
Oh my, lots of wonderful layers in that insightful question. First, let me address the Indian component because it's so true, and I don't know culturally. I'm sure there are like 1,001 different reasons for it, but I literally swear that scarcity mindset that so many of our parents have got passed down intergenerationally from their parents and their grandparents. And I don't know if it's just simply a fact of up until recently, it was, you know, up until the early 90s, every time I went to India, I mean, my overriding memory was just of excessive poverty. And like, you know, you'd get out of the airport and you're like swamped by like, oh, the saddest kids with like limbs missing and they're begging. And I mean, it's just, oh, like, I mean, there's so much sadness. And so I think you grow up in a scarcity mindset because you are constantly faced with the fact that, but for a sheer fluke of genetic luck, you grew up in one way and not another way. And it's in your face every single day. I don't know if the next generation of Indians to come over and be parents will be the same as what you and I experienced. But I The message that I got, I think, was unique because my dad is a CPA and an MBA and worked in finance. And at the time, we were living in a small town in Indiana that was very unique because it happened to be the headquarters of two Fortune 500 companies. And my dad ultimately became the chief financial officer of one of them. But I swear there were like three people who weren't like pasty white in the entire, you know, city outside of my family. And so we were always kind of outsiders. And so I think the message that I got about financial, the importance of being on top of your finances, had a subtext of to give you the power to get out of any situation where you might feel uncomfortable. And from my dad's standpoint, I'm guessing it came from a place of if you're facing discrimination or being kind of pushed out of the club, so to speak. And from my mom's side, I think it came from being a woman. And things have changed so much, but, you know, 40 years ago, like I'm 8 years old, and I'm just remembering what a very, very different time that was. So to get to your situation, I think what happens is part of it is just the boomerang syndrome. I see this all the time, that when parents exhibit one behavior to the extreme, kids oftentimes flip to the other side, just not even consciously. And it's just a reaction to feeling either constrained if their parents were very frugal, or if their parents were really profligate, feeling very, very insecure and wanting to have that security in their own life. So I think that just happens as a parent-child dynamic oftentimes, not all the times. But I think it's deeply exacerbated by the fact that we're the first generation that A, has easy access to debt, because, you know, in our parents' generation, you couldn't just go get a credit card or multiple credit cards. It was a pretty freaking big deal to go get a credit card. And you had to explain to the you know, loan officer at the bank how you're going to pay it back. You couldn't just get one through the mail or online. And then secondly, our parents were not as bombarded by media images the same way we are. Like if you went to see a Bollywood film, like you knew it was a film. You knew that wasn't your life. You knew you weren't going to end up like that, but it was still fun to watch. Nowadays, and same thing in the US, but nowadays there's this sense that we used to compare ourselves horizontally, I like to say, to the people around us who also didn't have access to debt. So our reference point was a group of people who couldn't live beyond their means very easily. To now we compare ourselves vertically to all of the images that we see in media, many of which are extreme. And the last thing I'll say on this is, you know, I, in different parts of my life, I have worked with clients who, when I have been in firms where I'm working on the high net worth side and we're dealing with people with $1 million and above, and I will have someone come in and they literally look like $1 million and they've got like the huge diamond ring or the fancy Rolex and the fancy car, and they're nearing retirement and they come in and they've got like nothing in savings. Like I can't manage the money for them because they don't have any money to manage. And so I have observed that most of the time, the people with outside of people with like Uber wealth, like private plane wealth, but most people with like what I would call $1 to $10 million in wealth, like wealthy, but not like over the moon wealthy, you would never guess, because they got that way by not denying themselves everything, but by having a mindset where financial flexibility was paramount. And I'm hesitating as I say that because, you know, what I'm thinking in my mind is, well, Srini had probably really like you're fouling your joy and your bliss. And that's, you know, there are a lot of different reasons why people end up in this place. And so taking you aside, culturally speaking, those are some of the issues that I see happening. And the last layer is that personal finance, it's not taught. We don't know. We don't have guidelines. So oftentimes we've already fallen into the pit. We've like face planted into the financial pit before we even realize it by buying too much car, too much home, or spending too much and racking up credit card debt. And then trying to dig out of it is so difficult. We're like, oh, what the heck? It's like gaining weight. You're like, I'm already fat. I might as well just keep eating the ice cream.
Yeah. So there are a lot of different layers here, like you said. And, you know, as we're talking about this, I've talked to numerous people about this subject here on the podcast. I've had Garrett Gunderson, who I'm sure you probably are familiar with.
Yeah.
Nature of Yours. And, you know, it's funny because Garrett Gunderson is like the polar opposite of Dave Ramsey, right? Like, you know, when I hear Dave Ramsey say some of the things he says, to me, it's like, wow, this is deprivation at a level where you're like, okay, there's no consideration for the fact that your life is an interdependent system. It's like, oh yeah, eat rice and beans for the next 5 years. It's like, well, what if you get really sick because of your shitty diet that saved you a ton of money? What does it matter that you're now out of debt because you're about to die? Like, there's no consideration for the fact that those two things. And not only that, you yourself have, you know, confronted your own mortality. So do you like, how do you wrestle with the paradox of, okay, yes, nobody wants to not be financially flexible. And ironically, I think that I've been more financially flexible without a regular job because I actually have had more cash on hand when I wasn't getting a steady paycheck than when I was.
Yeah.
So, you know, I wonder, you know, one, you know, when you, as somebody with your background, when you think about the Dave Ramsey version of, you know, dealing with money and the Garrett Gunderson version, you know, where do we go from there?
So I'm, if Dave and Garrett are at two ends of the spectrum, and let's say Dave is a one and Garrett is 100 on the aggressiveness scale with money, I'm probably a 40. I'm going to give myself a 48, right in line with my age. So I err towards Dave's notion of trying to live debt-free. I do believe there's something enormously powerful about living debt-free, which I believe you can do on a wide range of salaries, so long as you keep your and be happy, so long as you are very clear about squeezing the maximum amount of joy out of every dollar that you spend. And so I call this joy-based spending, and this is how I spend money. So periodically what I'll do is I write down everything I spend money on, and I have since 1992. And so I can tell you within about $5 for each year what I've spent money on, which may sound ludicrous, but it gives me such, like when I got divorced, I was super clear about how much of a new, you know, how much I could afford to spend on a new condo. And if I was moving to a new city, how much I had to earn. And, but most people hate living like that. So what I also do and counsel people to do is just write down what you spend money on for like a weekend. And at the end, don't add up the numbers, take out a yellow highlighter and highlight anything on that list that didn't bring you joy. And I call those things money leaks. And for most people, like, you know, there's the usual stuff, utility bills, a rent, mortgage. And, you know, the answer on the utility bills, you know, it's the same old, you really need 150 cable channels. But then you get to the interesting stuff, like, wow, that was like a really expensive dinner out. And I didn't even actually like those people. And, you know, or I'll hear this from parents like, oh my God, soccer lessons. The kids hate the coach. I hate driving them there. Why are we doing this? You know, so you start to get these bigger questions. And then what you can do with the extra money is free it up to redirect Part of it to savings or debt payoff if you need to, but the rest of it towards things that make you happier. So, you know, there's the proverbial don't spend $5 on a latte. Well, I actually spend $15 a day on lattes. I get three a day. I work remotely and I have usually two before 2 p.m. and then I have a decaf one later in the day, but I will sit in a coffee house for 3 hours and savor that latte. So my $5 over that 3 hours is like an extreme amount of joy. And so you can't just say, don't buy this, don't buy that. I think it's related to your joy. And I think many, many people, and what's missing in the dialogue with so many financial gurus that we see on TV is the linkage between money and true happiness, which speaks to some broader thoughts that I have about what is the meaning of being wealthy versus wealthy, W-E-L-L-T-H-Y, lots of issues around that. But I don't believe in deprivation. I believe in strategically smart spending that squeezes out as much joy as you can. And the last thing I'll say on that front is another tool that works well is most of us work about 2,000 hours, sadly, a year, at least in the U.S. You know, let's call it 40 hours a week, 50 weeks a year, give or take. And so you can take your annual after-tax income and divide it by 2,000. And now you've got your hourly wage and maybe it's $10 an hour, $15 or $20 an hour, but you see something that costs $100. And now you can do the math and say, is it worth, you know, 5, 6, 7 hours of my time, depending upon your imputed hourly wage? And the answer may be yes. You know, I mean, I am renovating a condo right now and I just bought this ridiculously expensive hanging pendant because it brings me exquisite joy to look at. But I am also talking to you wearing yoga pants that I bought 5 years ago that are like starting to shred because I just don't care what my yoga pants look like.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
It's funny to hear you talk about this because, you know, I think about it from two different angles. One, I think about it from joy, but I also think about it from the role that environment plays in behavior. So I'll give you two examples. You know, one, I spend, I think, $700 every year on a season pass for skiing. And I know for a fact that this leads to, you know, meetings with friends, and I'm an avid snowboarder. So that's well worth the $750. Like, I think, and not only that, I go skiing 5 times, it pays for itself.
Yeah.
But there's one other thing that I noticed, and this was particularly around clothes. For the longest time, I was like, who gives a shit what you're dressed like? And one of my friends turned me on to proper cloth, which is these really ridiculously expensive dress shirts that are custom made. And I noticed immediately two things started to happen. One, I started to get a lot more compliments on my clothes. Two, I started carrying myself differently. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, okay, you know what? I'm replacing everything in my wardrobe. I narrowed it down to 4 or 5 shirts. Luckily, I got a bunch for my birthday. But I was like, wow, I'd rather have 5 of these than, you know, 20 that I don't like at all, even though they're expensive. Because I saw it as a sort of, okay, I was like, you know what? This is an investment as far as I see it in terms of how I feel about myself. And, you know, I wear these on every stage, that I speak on. So there's that aspect of it. So I wonder, you know, how you, so you said, you know, deprivation is not what we're after here. How you balance joy-based spending with paying off debt and getting yourself into a situation. Because I think that, you know, when I think about flexibility, what I think about in terms of flexibility is how long can I go if I don't make any more money based on what I currently have, not how much is coming in every month. I think I look at it in terms of, okay, how much time does this give me? That's how I measure it.
Yeah. So a couple things. I'm with you on the clothes front. When I am working remotely from a coffee house, I look like a college student because thank God many Indian women have so much oil in their hair and on their face that we look way younger, longer, even though it gives us acne when we're growing up. And so I literally look like a college student as I'm bopping around. But when I'm doing work things, I have 5 amazing outfits for the summer and spring, summer, and I have 5 amazing outfits for fall, winter. And they're investment pieces. And the idea came to me. I had spent my junior year at Oxford, and I came over like the classic American, had these 2 huge Samsonite suitcases just packed with all my shitty clothes. And my flatmates had like these tiny little pieces of luggage, and inside were the most exquisite sweaters of this beautiful material and cut. And they had so few pieces, but they looked unbelievable all the time because they bought high quality stuff that lasted forever and, you know, looked fresh and new forever. And that was my first exposure to seeing people live something that my grandfather always said, which was buy few, but buy the best that you can comfortably afford at that time. And I think that leads into this broader issue, not in your case, but just across the U.S. in particular, we don't buy few and buy the best. We tend to buy a ton and then throw it away when we get tired of it. And so I think shifting your mindset that way allows you to have some pretty luxurious things. But like you, it's 5 amazing shirts, not 15 crappy ones. And in terms of the way you were talking about money, I'd call that your burn rate. And when you work for yourself, you're a lot like a startup company. And startup companies think about burn rates, like how much time do they have to keep pushing themselves towards, you know, launch or the beta version of their product or service with the cash that they have on hand, either self-funded or from outside folks. And it's the same thing for you. You're like a mini entrepreneurial company, and that's your burn rate. So that's a completely rational way of thinking about it. And I think it's what's happened is we've shifted, you know, in our parent generation, nobody had a side gig, and like it was really rare to work for yourself. And so, you know, we can't have a one size fits all way of thinking about quote incomes, because so many of us have multiple streams of income or different ways of working than prior generations. And then to get to your last point about credit card debt, that makes it so much harder to deal with paying off credit card debt, because you don't have a paycheck coming in twice a month that you can say, I'm going to siphon off X. And so my rule of thumb is basically, if you have less than $5,000 of credit card debt, add an extra $50 every month to the minimum monthly payment, however you have, like whatever you have to do to get that money. Like hop on TaskRabbit and see what service of yours, like you could teach snowboarding lessons, like something that would be fun and that you could get an extra $50 a month to add. If you have between $5,000 and $10,000 of credit card debt, add an extra $50 to your minimum monthly payment. And if you have over $10,000, add an extra $150. And if you do that, you will, and you have a typical mid-teens interest rate on your credit card debt, you will compress the number of years it takes to pay off that debt dramatically. Using that formula, you can, depending on the interest rate, you can get all that debt paid off in 3 to 5 years. And one of the other benefits is while you're, you know, on TaskRabbit, or there's another great site for women, Hire My Mom, a lot of these sites where you can use your natural skills and gifts to do something on the weekends, if you've got a day job, or anytime if you're working for yourself, to augment your income. And the good thing is, while you're augmenting your income, you're busy, so you can't spend more. And so that's how I encourage people to get themselves to start the wheels moving, getting out of credit card debt.
Okay, so that's one I thought. So let's say that you have, you know, for example, you and I both speak, so you know, you get large cash infusions when you speak, sometimes upwards of $8,000 or $9,000. And if you have an opportunity to make just huge dents in the debt, do you suggest that? Or how would you balance that with also having to live? Like, how would you deal with those two things? Because this is the plan that I'm formulating in my head right now. Because I know I have, you know, 3 to 4 or even 5 paid speaking engagements that are coming up in the next month or two. And I'm like, okay, how could I literally wipe out the debt on one credit card entirely and still manage my living expenses? That's what I'm thinking, because I want to be out of this situation. Not only that, I need those lines of credit for emergencies.
Yeah. So what I would say is, and this is why I know people hate tracking their money, but it's so powerful, because like I can tell you exactly how much I need for my essentials. And I think it depends for everyone how much discomfort they have with living with that debt. If you have extreme discomfort with living with that debt, just like ripping a Band-Aid off, the single best way to do it is identify what it costs you per month to just have the bare basics. Mm-hmm. And you decide based on the number of speaking engagements that you have right now with Clarity, how much you would take out of each of those in order. And then you decide, do you want 3 months of safety? Do you want 6 months of safety? And everything else goes to paying off that credit card debt. And really, really, really importantly, when you reach out to the credit card company and you pay that, you want to make sure that money is all applied to the principal. Mm-hmm. And so The extreme method of doing it would be to cut back to bare bones and put everything else to debt right. pay down.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about that in terms of, okay, how I create a runway that's what I was thinking of myself is, okay, create a runway for however long I need and then, you know, allocate everything else towards getting rid of it.
Yeah, exactly. And some people pin 3 months as, you know, they're like, I am confident that if I can just keep things going for 3 months, I'm going to get more work. Mm-hmm. I'm like a nervous Nelly. So I'd be like, I need six months of a runway. So it's very personal. But yeah, that's the conceptually the strategy.
Okay, interesting. So I think, you know, what's interesting is that we're talking about a lot of tactical sort of behavioral changes. But to me, I think part of, you know, what's funny is when I got here, you know, after living at my parents' house for a long time, you know, I finally had, you know, money coming in from speaking. And, you know, I was really diligent about saving because my speaking agent told me, he said, put aside 50% of everything you earn, because if it slows down, you want to make sure you're not screwed. And it slowed down to the point where I got nothing for a year. And mm-hmm. that's how I was able to sustain myself. But I had to actually, but I ended up burning through a lot of what I had saved because of that. And so suddenly a lot of the old patterns and behaviors, I'm like, oh my God, I'm back in this situation where yeah. I'm trying to scramble with credit cards. How the hell did this happen? So part of me wonders, you know, we're talking about tactical changes, you and I right now. And then I wonder, you know, how do you unwind this sort of scarcity that ultimately leads to the change in behavior? Because I think that if you don't change the story, you can change the behavior, but you're putting a Band-Aid on a bullet wound, it seems like.
Oh my God, I want to hug you through like, through the intra webs of the internet for asking that question, because I have to tell you, I'm bored stiff of tips. Like, if I have to give one more set of tips, I feel like when I give tips, I'm addressing the symptoms and not the root problems. And I have decided from this point forward in my career, I want to focus on the root problems. And there are three big questions that I am really focused on right now that I think we all need to ask ourselves, because it's the answers to these questions that are leading us to places that are causing us to be like rats on a hamster wheel in so many different ways, not just monetarily. So the first one is, what if everything we've been taught about money and making it, and I put that in air quotes, because I mean it both literally and figuratively, is just all wrong? The second question is, what if success as defined by modern society is really nothing more than a recipe for disconnection from self and others, community, life overall? And the third is, what if instead of always looking for more, which is sort of part of the American dream, you can fill in the blank, whether it's more money, more fame, more status, more house, more car, we focused on optimizing our own definition of enough. And I think that could have such a huge impact on the planet, just from a variety of different, you know, global climate change issues if we weren't consuming as much. But more importantly, I think it would have a huge impact on our happiness if we all thought about those three questions and talked about them more, because I think it is rote answers to those, to the reverse of those questions, that have led so many of us to spend in a way that doesn't make us happy. And again, because I have spent half my career working on what's called the institutional side of the finance business, but the second half working with individuals, and I do my paid work and then pro bono work. And in my paid work, I have worked with extremely wealthy individuals. And what I have found is wealth, it's so true, it does not make you happier. I can't tell you how many miserable, wealthy people I have encountered. And it's because if your soul isn't nourished, it does not matter how much money you have, like, you are still aching. And I feel like collectively we are aching because of things that we as a society are being subtly propelled towards are not the things that bring us great joy, like family and friendship and giving back and white space in our heads to think and be creative. Those aren't things that we give lip service to. We talk about them, but we don't really value them. We value money, success, power, money, success, power, fame. Those are the things that we are subtly or not so subtly often idolizing.
Yeah. It's so funny you say that. You may have seen it. David Brooks, the New York Times columnist, recently wrote a book called The Second Mountain, which is all about this. And he talks extensively about that. He had a lengthy chat with Oprah on it. For any of you guys listening who haven't heard it, I'd recommend you go listen to it. But more importantly, I recommend everybody read that book because it really was an eye-opening look into this idea of, okay, these are all these things that you think will make you happy. And I remember we had another psychologist here. She said, look, you get this thing you want that you say you've always wanted. And what ends up happening is because of hedonic adaptation, it just becomes your new normal. You know, like suddenly your whole reference group changes. And I've seen this even in my own life where I thought, oh, you know what? I'm going to get a book deal. It's going to be this like amazing thing. And I think by the time the second book came out, it was, you know, it was no longer about the joy of getting to write a book. It was like, why the hell isn't this selling more copies? Why are my friends selling more books? You know, and it was such a sort of moment of what the hell. That it was like a gut check moment to make me realize that, wow, there is a grain of truth. As I heard Josh Radner, the guy who was on How I Met Your Mother, he was doing an interview with this guy, Sam Jones, on Off Camera. And he said, a successful career in the arts is rigged for dissatisfaction. So you have to find something else. And I thought about that. He said, if it wasn't, then why would you have movie stars and celebrities in rehab and dying and, you know, committing suicide? He said, you know, I had another friend who said, yeah, but I would rather be miserable and rich than, you know, poor and happy. So it's a funny thing. And I wonder, you know, how we resolve those two paradoxes.
Well, I'm just telling you, I've worked for two different billionaires over the course of my career. And it's interesting when you work for billionaires because you are clearly the help. Like you are there. I was, you know, partner level or senior level person within the organization. But by virtue of being in that orbit, I have seen, you know, the private plane, five huge, huge, you know, 25,000 square foot homes in multiple countries kind of life. And I'm telling you, being miserable and being rich and miserable really does not trump being poor and happy. It really, really, really does not. And I wouldn't be able to say that in my bones with such certainty, but for having seen the myriad of issues that come along with extreme wealth, never knowing whether people want to be with you because they like you or they want your money, being afraid to, you know, open your mail or, you know, answer the phone because, and these folks don't do either for themselves. They have other people do that for them, but because there's they're being barraged daily with requests for money, philanthropic and otherwise. I've had some of the people I work for have to have safety and security guards around their kids for kidnapping because they're worried about their kids being kidnapped for ransom. Now, that's obviously the extreme, extreme end of wealth. But I have, by nature of my career, seen that. And that's why I think this question of optimizing for enough. For some people, enough may be 10 of those amazing shirts you have and the $70,000 Mercedes and a beautiful condo in Miami Beach that they live out of. And those things bring them exquisite joy. And then they love to be with friends. And that's their version of enough. Someone else's version may be living in a tiny home. So it's not to judge like how much you have. It's focusing on it's like this shift in your mindset, and David Brooks describes it beautifully. He's had several columns about this topic. John Bogle wrote a book. He's passed now. He was the founder of Vanguard. And the book is called Enough. And it's just so beautiful. And I think that's the question we want to ask ourselves. Like, what is enough? Not from the standpoint of deprivation, but from the standpoint of happiness. Mm-hmm. Optimizing enough for happiness. I think that's the question du jour of the globe that I would put out there.
Amazing. Well, I think that actually really kind of makes a perfect place to bring us full circle to where we started. So I wonder how your own perception of enough changed after your confrontation with your own mortality.
So it's interesting. Probably the biggest way in which it changed is for years and years I had struggled with depression and anxiety. And I thought it was just, you know, garden level depression and anxiety. I work in finance. Like, pretty much everybody seems to be depressed and or anxious. And I was always too busy to seek proper help and care. And when I did, it would be for my general physician. And I'd be like, I'm depressed. I'm not, like, I have these mood swings. And you know, my general physician would prescribe more Prozac for me. So, you know, I've been on Prozac for ages. And after getting divorced and moving, I moved to Portland, Oregon with my books and my Mini Cooper. And I didn't even bring a fork with me. I started completely fresh. And what happened were two things. I'll come back to my health in a moment. The first thing that happened was after the near-death experience, I made some bold changes. A huge one was moving to a city where I didn't know anyone. And I bought a condo for cash, because that's just how I think. So it wasn't huge. I had the experience of starting as an adult with a blank slate from the standpoint of both possessions and my story. And in terms of possessions, my place looks like a jewel box. When my parents come here, my dad's like, this is better than a 6-star hotel. Like, it is beautiful. Every piece in my place is gorgeous, but it's enough. I have just enough. I have no excess. There is no clutter. And that was a luxury, because I literally didn't come with a fork, you know? So every single thing I brought in, I was very deliberate about. So that was one thing that came about circuitously from the near-death experience. The other one, though, was I finally realized that your health is something you cannot take for granted. And all my life, I felt like I was, you know, running 100 miles an hour, hitting a brick wall and then collapsing and then picking up and repeating. But, you know, I just thought that was normal, because especially when I was on the corporate side of finance, that's just how people behave. And so I'd had a near-death experience, because I was divorced, because I was in a new town, because it's Portland, which is a very funky town, my general physician was like, I don't know you. I'm not going to give you antidepressants until you start seeing a psychiatrist. And so I started seeing one regularly. And lo and behold, it turns out I'm not just depressed or anxious. I'm actually bipolar. The reason it was never diagnosed is that when I'm in hypomania, most people in hypomania, when they have bipolar, do visibly self-destructive things, spend money wantonly, engage in risky sexual behavior, really extreme things to the outside world. When I was in hypomania, I would go into extreme workaholism, and I'd pull all-nighters, and I'd sleep 3 or 4 hours a night. And in finance, that's just called being a good employee. And so it was never, the behavior was never diagnosed. And then it completely crashed. And so the other circuitous thing that came out was that I actually got proper mental health care. And now I'm a huge advocate around mental health. And I try and talk about my bipolar as much as I possibly can, because I feel like there is so much stigma around mental health. And there's so many things wrong with the mental health system. And if I could put a neon light on my head flashing, I'm bipolar, I would, because I really want to help normalize the conversation. So I would say those are the two biggest things. Obviously, the mental health one is I would argue the most important, but I want to circle back to the things one of bringing things into my life. The thing that I also realize is it's not just about things. When you start fresh, you also have a chance to tell your story again. And you can drag all the crap from your junior high school days that are still tormenting you, which in my case, they very much were, into the present, or you can just choose to let that past go and start with where you are right now. And that was really fascinating. Every time I opened my mouth to someone new and they wanted to know who I am, where I'm from, I had a choice of what story to tell. And I could choose to tell a woe is me victim story, or I could choose to tell a moving forward story. And so those two ends, the mental health diagnosis and just the realization of what it's like as an adult to be able to start with a blank slate and be really conscious about what possessions or what thoughts or what stories you want to let back in your life. That's what came out of it, albeit in a very circuitous manner.
Amazing. Well, I think that makes a really fitting place to wrap up our conversation. So I have one final question for you, which is how we finish all of our interviews at the Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Genuine vulnerability. I know in the day and era of Brené Brown, that sounds like a hashtag, but true vulnerability is what I think connects us to each other. And I find the most unmistakably creative, delightful, brilliant, and inspiring people are the ones that just are themselves, just put it all out there. And that's what makes somebody truly shine in the way you are describing.
Awesome. Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your story and your insights with our listeners. This has been really, really eye-opening for me, and one of those conversations that I will probably go back to 100 times. Where can people find out more about you, your work, and everything that you're up to?
So two places. I maintain a personal website called Money Zen, M-O-N-E-Y, and then Zen, like Zen Buddhism, moneyzen.com. It has various iterations depending upon how much time I have to tend to it, but it's a place where I like to share as much information about personal finance as I possibly can. And I don't do a ton of teaching or speaking, but when I am, that's where the information is. And then my big passion project these days is, like you, a podcast that you can find on iTunes or Stitcher, Google Play, and it's called the True Wealth Podcast, where wealth is spelled W-E-L-L-T-H. So those are the two places, moneyzen.com and the True Wealth Podcast are the two best places to find me.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we'll wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you. Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.